Budgets are tight in many Arizona cities, but some are finding ways to do their jobs better. The answer is technology.
They're talking to each other, they're sharing with each other, and they're learning from each other, and I think that's really taking place in Arizona right now.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, Arizona's digital cities. Also, Phoenix has big plans to make itself more bike-friendly.
The immigration conversation reaches a fever pitch.
The National Park Service is looking to unload some of its artifacts and balancing irrigation with drought.
We want it to be really more focused on the aspects of the outdoors that we really need water in order to be able to create the environments we want.
Plus, Mexico's disgust over corruption.
And we stuff our faces, all in the name of journalism. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. Quick check of valley traffic. 51 southbound, an accident at Bell is blocking the right lane. And on US 60 westbound at McClintock, the exit ramp is restricted there. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 74 degrees. That would match yesterday's high. Partly cloudy skies tonight, overnight lows in the lower 50s. It's 71 degrees right now.
Immigrants hoping for relief from deportation will gather around the state tonight as President Obama will announce a program protecting as many as 5 million people. Even though Arizona has been an immigration battleground for many years, the number of immigrants who lack legal status living here has dropped significantly. The state's also been home to a renewed church sanctuary movement in which immigrants who face deportation take shelter in churches. Authorities don't typically arrest people in churches. Immigrant advocates will gather tonight in Phoenix and Tucson to watch and reflect on the announcement.
The federal government so far has paid more than $225 million to American Indian landowners, and it's restored 375,000 acres to tribal governments. From Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
As part of the 2012 Cobell settlement, the federal government set aside $1.9 billion to offer fair market value for land that's been split among owners over successive generations since the 1880s. The Interior Department then puts the land in the tribe's trust. Interior Deputy Secretary Mike Connor says access to landowner information has been a challenge, but the agency has improved outreach, and of the offers made, 42% have been accepted. Connor says many people have a strong cultural or personal connection to their land.
The last thing any of us want is to have return of any of these funds to the U.S. Treasury at the end of the program in 2022.
So far, the Interior Department has made agreements with 12 tribes. It's finalizing an agreement with the Navajo Nation and will be working with more Arizona tribes in the coming months. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Thousands of Mexican citizens are on the streets protesting today. They're being led by the families of 43 missing students. Those students were abducted in September by police linked to drug gangs, and their families want answers from the government. KJZZ's Lorne Madelon is in Mexico and joins me now. Lorne, where are you?
I am in Ojinaga, Chihuahua. That is a dusty border town of about 30,000 people across the Rio Grande from Presidio, Texas.
And what are you seeing there? What's going on right now?
But you know what we're seeing? We're seeing revulsion mixed with patriotism today, as is going to unfold right across all of Mexico today. And the patriotic fervor is because this is Día de la Revolución, Revolution Day. It's a time to celebrate for the 104th time the legitimate accomplishments of the Mexican Revolution, which lifted and improved the lives of millions of impoverished Mexicans. The revulsion, however, is tainting this day in many parts of Mexico, because the day is being used as an outlet, if you will, Mark, for people to express their revulsion with the crime and the aftermath being that they're dissatisfied with the reaction on the part of pretty much every level of government, but in particular, their wrath is directed towards Mexico's Attorney General, who disdainfully left a press conference saying, "Ya me cansé, I am tired." And that immediately started a viral reaction on social media with people saying to the effect, "You're tired, we are tired. We are tired of this nexus, this narco-political nexus that has plagued Mexico for generations."
Are you expecting a lot of people on the streets where you are today?
There are a lot of people on the streets. Most of them are subdued. I would say that there is not the inflamed protest that we will be seeing today in Mexico City that we are seeing, where caravans from different states of Mexico are converging on the Zocalo, the seat of power since before Mexico was a modern state. I think one takeaway here, Mark, that should not be ignored is the fact that some people are saying that as terrible as this incident is, that perhaps because the civil movement, civil society has been so mobilized in the aftermath of this crime, that this will be harnessed as a way to change Mexico, to improve Mexico, to introduce legitimate political reform. I also have to point out that at the same time, the president of Mexico is defending his wife against the purchase of a $7 million mansion in Mexico City in a very Tony neighborhood. That is obviously a sidebar, but it is only serving to underscore, because it's reared its head this week, it's only served to underscore, frankly, the corruption that many people feel is prevalent in Mexico.
KJZZ's Lauren Madelon. Lauren, thanks.
My pleasure.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. President Obama says he plans to change the status of more than 5 million undocumented people living in this country. Tonight he'll announce a new executive order on immigration, and you'll be able to hear it on KJZZ.
According to the White House, the president's plan would prevent the deportation of as many as 4 million undocumented immigrants if they have lived here for 5 years and have no criminal record. An additional 1 million will be granted protection through additional unspecified parts of this presidential order. But one blow to immigration advocates, the parents of Dreamers, those people who fall under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or the DREAM Act, DACA, will not be granted deportation reprieve. Republicans are critical of this, not surprisingly. For a few minutes today, we want to put aside the politics and talk about how this executive order might work in practice with actual people who will be affected. On the line is Myra Rubio-Limon. Limon, a undocumented immigrant who was brought to the U.S. as a child. She received protection from deportation under DACA, and it looks like her parents will not be a part of the 5 million to remain here legally. Myra, what's your reaction to all of this?
Like you said, John, it's a blow because we have been fighting for this for so long. But just the fact that President Obama is going to make an announcement shows that if we keep fighting, we can reach what we want.
And did you expect that your parents might be included here?
You know what? I did. We don't know exactly what the announcement is going to be, but this is what we're fighting for. You know, they are the original Dreamers. They came before us, and they are the reason we keep on fighting. We want something for our parents. We want something for the Dreamers who were left out in the first time. We want something for those people who are working hard every day. And yes, I do want my parents to be included, as well as the parents of the other members or my brothers and sisters in our organization.
Also with us is Cyrus Mehta, who's an immigration attorney here in New York. Cyrus, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thank you, John.
So what would be the difference between Myra's parents and the people who fall under this classification of having been here in the United States for 5 years unauthorized, without a criminal record?
We're still waiting for the details to come out, but what we've heard so far is that only the parents of U.S. citizen children or lawful permanent residents will get this reprieve. These are the 4 million parents who are likely to get the reprieve. And therefore, Myra's parents, who are the parents of a DACA recipient, may not be included. But again, we don't have the details. There may be other forms of relief that might become available. So it's basically waiting to see with great anticipation.
And you're an immigration lawyer, not a constitutional lawyer. Do you think the omission of Myra's parents might have to do with the president's sense of his constitutional limits or his political limits, or this is just something he's not allowed to do?
The president has broad discretion with respect to immigration matters, particularly with regards to whom he wants to remove from the United States. And this is essentially a political decision. It's highly controversial. He's pushed this through. And in order for it to be palatable, it probably makes more political sense, at least from his perspective, to limit it to parents of U.S. citizen children or lawful permanent residents. But again, we don't have the details. There might be other reprieves for parents of DACA recipients. I believe it should be as broad as possible.
But from your perspective, Myra, the president may say that this is a broken immigration system, but if it's still going to be politics after this speech tonight, it's still broken as far as you're concerned, right?
Correct.
So how did DACA change your life? And help me to understand, and for our listeners to understand, how you and your family have really followed all the rules with the exception of crossing a border.
So I graduated in 2009 from Southgate Senior High School. And at that moment in my life, I did not want to pursue a higher education just for the fact that I knew I wasn't going to be able to do much because of the high cost of going to school and because I didn't have a social to get a job. So when DACA came out, it changed my life completely. I am now able to have a driver's license. I am driving with no fear, knowing that I am not at risk of deportation. I am now able to attend Miami-Dade College. I can help my family in so many more ways. And you know, this is really life-changing. I'm out of the shadows. I can publicly say I am not afraid. I can go to work. I am a member of society that I know I'm working hard for what I want. And, you know, this is something that is going to help everyone so much, just for the fact that you have people who are even afraid when they're walking down the street and they see a police officer, they turn the other way. That is not what America is about. That is not what we want for our community.
All right. What Myra describes here is that the principles of DACA allow her to help her parents, even though they remain unauthorized, in the sense that she doesn't have any fear. She can help to assist them in paperwork and going out and dealing with whatever it is they need to deal with in their lives. Will this executive order create a community of people who no longer have fear of deportation, who can also help family members, who can also be of assistance to people in their own communities?
Absolutely. You know, John, we have a broken immigration system, and it's been broken for more than two decades. And that's the reason why we have such a buildup of undocumented people. And this executive policy will allow millions of people to come out of the woodwork and live normal lives, as Myra just described. It's going to be wonderful for these people. And this is just a step in the right direction. It's not going to be perfect. But we had DACA in 2012, which was limited to a small group of people. Now we have a broader group of people. And as more and more people come out of the woodwork, get legalized, and become part of America and this great country and the dream, they will be able to push for greater relief. Ultimately, we need Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform. The president can only do so much through an executive order, but we need to have Congress to pass a law that would fix the whole problem and solidify the status of these people and many more.
Cyrus Madoff, before we go, what Obama is doing tonight is nothing new, right? There have been amnesties and unilateral actions from other presidents.
Sure. President Reagan, as well as the first President Bush, did something quite similar. After the first amnesty was announced in 1986, their family members were left out of the legislation. So both Presidents Reagan and Bush passed executive orders that allowed family members to stay in the United States just like this with work authorization. And what was remarkable is that ultimately the U.S. Congress incorporated this executive order into law. And that's historically been the case.
Even the crazy way we try to fix our broken immigration system.
And even with DACA, you know, the Senate bill that got passed last year, which the House has not taken up, incorporated DACA into the legislation.
So presidents acting laterally, Congress picks up the slack later on, but it's still a system that's broken. Cyrus, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for
having me. Cyrus Mehta is an immigration attorney, and we earlier spoke with Myra Rubio Limon, who's an undocumented immigrant in Homestead, Florida.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Still to come, more bighorn sheep have been released into the Catalina Mountains, and despite some bad headlines, officials are optimistic.
Unlike the instant messaging world that we live in on a day-to-day basis, wildlife success or failure can't be determined in the short term.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It'll be nothing like what the East Coast has been going through. We will cool off just a little bit over the next couple of days.
No snow, though, huh?
No, not at all. Partly cloudy skies for tonight with a low temperature around 50 or so. Then for tomorrow, partly to mostly cloudy, a 10% chance for rain and a high of 70. And then back to mostly sunny skies this weekend with high temperatures in the lower 70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 13%, mostly clear, and 71 degrees at KJZZ. To the Valley Freeway is an accident on the 51 southbound at Bell Road. That's blocking the right lane. And there's also a collision on the 60 westbound at McClintock. That's restricting the off-ramp.
KJZZ is supported by the CORE Institute, fellowship-trained orthopedic physicians helping patients keep life in motion. Offices valley-wide. TheCoreInstitute.com.
Five Arizona cities seem to be doing a good job of using information technology to help them run better. The Center for Digital Government puts out the Digital City Survey by ranking the top 10 cities in four population-based categories. Phoenix and Mesa come in at number 6 and 10, respectively, among the biggest cities. Scottsdale is ranked 5th, Avondale 1st, and Marana 6th in their categories. Todd Sander is the executive director of the Center for Digital Government.
What really constitutes a digital city for purposes of our survey is one where the elected and appointed leaders are in sync with their community and the needs and expectations. And in those communities, technology is viewed as a strategic solution to improve government service and not simply an expense to be cut. And that really is what differentiates the leaders and the winners that we recognize from maybe some other cities or jurisdictions.
In general, how are cities doing as far as using technology to improve things?
They're doing pretty well. In fact, what we see, particularly in the cities that we rank the highest, is a recognition that technology is really part of the solution, particularly during difficult economic times. It's a way to better balance resources and better meet community demands, even at a time when it's hard to find the money to do everything that needs to be done.
So several Arizona cities made your list, and you break them down. You break your list down by population. So one Arizona city came in each of these categories, and I'm wondering if there's anything that these cities all had in common, or were each of them ranked well for doing different things?
They're each doing different things, but one of the things that they have in common, and I think one of the things that makes Arizona a little bit special, particularly this year, is the level of collaboration and cooperation that's taking place amongst the jurisdictions. One of the things that we see when we get a spread of cities across population categories doing well like this is the fact that they're talking to each other, they're sharing with each other, and they're learning from each other. And I think that's really taking place in Arizona right now. In addition to the city survey, we also do a county survey each year. And that's true of Maricopa County is, you know, engaged with them too. So there's a real regional approach to good government and the use of technology to support government going on in the Phoenix Valley.
Are the things that bigger cities like Phoenix and Mesa are doing different than smaller cities like, for example, Marana is doing?
You might think so, but it's not really true. A lot of it is the same. It's using information technology to help elected leaders make better decisions. It's engaging the public in the process of government, irrespective of the community size. It's opening up the processes of government so that they're open and they're transparent. It's, you know, making data available to citizens. Those things are pretty consistent across all population categories.
When you talk about cities sort of using data and helping to use technology to make government run more smoothly, can you give me some examples of how cities are doing that?
Well, I think a lot of what we saw and a lot of what our judges really liked about the Phoenix Valley cities is the way they're using technology to support their planning processes. So there's some good examples we saw there. There's a number of things taking place in the public safety arena around kind of smart policing and safer neighborhoods. even from an efficiency standpoint, there's a lot of good things going on with improvements to document management and process management, making that more efficient and making it easier for people to do business with government electronically.
Todd Sander is Executive Director of the Center for Digital Government. Todd, thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Phoenix and the phrase car culture have gone hand-in-glove compartment for many years, but efforts to modify that picked up steam this week as the city council adopted a comprehensive bicycle master plan. Kerry Wilcoxon, Phoenix traffic engineer, says biking enthusiasts wanted four things from the new plan.
Connectivity was the main part, making sure that the bike lanes that are there connect to something that they want to bike to. Maintenance of existing bike facilities to make sure that we keep up the facilities and make sure that they are still bikeable. Enforcement of some of the existing bike laws. And then finally, balance. We heard time and again that the biking community wanted balance between the motorized and non-motorized aspects that go into the designing and building of our streets.
Mayor Greg Stanton believes the plan is part of Phoenix moving into the future.
This will go a long way to help us be the kind of city, build the kind of economy that we want, recruit the kind of people that we need for our future. So I just want to make the point, the connection between bike friendliness and the right kind of economic development.
Ray Dovalina is the city's street transportation director. He says opportunities for bike riding are growing.
We're up to around 700 miles of bike routes, bike lanes, connections to trails, to parks. So this was the next generation. What is the next generation of bike infrastructure for the city of Phoenix? And from sort of the history of Phoenix, it's been predominantly a more of a car-centric type of environment. And so we've kind of gone away from, you know, trying to do a multitude of different multimodal transportation techniques. So it was sort of a combination of things that kind of tied together to the holistic aspect of multimodal transportation for the city of Phoenix.
Hmm. How important do you think it is for the bike culture to be part of the greater culture of Phoenix? As you mentioned, a lot of people think of this area as being car focused.
There's aspects that I'm going to be focusing on, at least from my view of the department and how we view transportation. And the first one is public safety. That is very important. It's not only, you know, how do we design our streets and operate and maintain them, but also how do we educate the public, and from all ages, from the toddlers to the people, you know, the kids that go to school, to the elderly folks that live in our community. And so I think that's a major focus that we're going to continue on and try to enhance one aspect of that. The second one is environmental sustainability. How do we, with the advent of, we do have better cars out there, more efficient cars, but also people, the new generations are looking for options. And we're trying to make sure that our streets are providing more of an opportunity for options for citizens to, if they don't want to live in the suburbs, but they want to live in the urban air core, they have an option of riding their bike, being more mobile, walking that. But also keep in mind that we do have people that live in the suburban areas of Phoenix. So we also need to balance, depending on where you're at, balance those streets and look at how we connect to the freeway system, how do we connect to our street system, and how do we work, play, and sort of live in an environment where we all have to be kind of, you know, coordinated with all the different modes.
There are a lot of people who don't feel safe riding a bike around Phoenix. So how do you make Phoenix a safer place to ride a bike?
Having good conversations with the community, having more education for the young kids and for their parents that are driving, you know, every day. But it's also working regionally with other communities because, as well, you know, we have not only the people that live in Phoenix, but we have other people that live outside of Phoenix that come to work to downtown Phoenix or other areas in Phoenix. So it's kind of working holistically with the region, with the Maricopa Association of Governments, our Metropolitan Planning Organization, mm-hmm. and having a focus on working towards education. We're all here, you know, traveling in different modes, and we have to be respectful in how we travel every day.
One more question about the bike master plan, Ray. What excites you about it? Is there something in there that really you feel like this is really getting at the core of what we needed to do?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we want to look at is what was the low-hanging fruit of certain corridors that would be susceptible to bike infrastructure. One of the things that we get a lot is, well, put bike lanes everywhere. Well, and that's difficult to do, but also we need to be strategic on how we do these bike infrastructure projects.
Ray Dovalina is the Street Transportation Director for the City of Phoenix.
Arizona Game and Fish released more bighorn sheep into the Catalina Mountains north of Tucson this morning. It's the second release of the sheep in the area. Game and Fish officials released 31 bighorn sheep last year. 17 of them are now dead. Jim DeVos is the director of wildlife with the Arizona Game and Fish Department and says the agency's work on species release and reintroduction is guided by a long-term plan.
We've got a plan that is established by the commission, which is our policy board. We also oftentimes develop species-specific plans, for example, for bighorn sheep or black-footed ferrets or rainbow trout, for that matter.
How flexible are those plans in a situation like what you're dealing with bighorn, where several of them have been killed by mountain lions? Are those plans flexible at all?
Certainly they are. You know, we operate with the concept of adaptive management. So you make an action, you evaluate that action, look at the consequences, and determine if changes are needed. One of the things that's important to think about in wildlife management is, particularly when you're trying to reestablish populations, unlike the instant messaging world that we live in on a day-to-day basis, wildlife success or failure can't be determined in the short term. So, you know, we do have flexibility, but are reluctant in the absence of very real and hard data to make a change, particularly with bighorn sheep. We have such a long-term successful record of repatriation that 1 year where we've had some lions kill is not a deal breaker. The other thing to think about, too, is we had sheep killed by lions. We also had some live. And we had young produced in the Catalinas for the first time in 30 years.
I know there was some discussion about whether or not to tell the public when this most recent herd was going to be released into the Catalinas. And I'm curious about whether this is something that Game and Fish will continue to do, to basically say, yes, we're going to do this, but we're not going to tell you exactly when and where because we don't want a huge crowd there.
Well, I think let's look at the reason why a huge crowd is not in the best interest. Our concern is animal safety and welfare. These animals have been taken from another place in Arizona, brought here. Very typically, when we do these type of releases, we do it without fanfare so that animals have a chance to be released without being frightened and running completely out of the area. So it's the fact that we don't broadly announce releases is nothing new. It's all about animal welfare and safety.
Are some animals more susceptible to being freaked out by a lot of people than others?
You know what? Bighorn live in some of the most inhospitable areas in not just Arizona, but desert bighorn, wherever they occur. So, you know, they're not used to a lot of frequent human contact. Deer, on the other hand, are scattered throughout most of Arizona. They have a high degree of contact with the public, whether it's somebody driving down a dirt road or somebody hiking. So, yeah, bighorn are proven in the literature and by experience to not adjust well to a lot of human contact.
Jim DeVos is the Director of Wildlife for the Arizona Game and Fish Department.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is Pete Scholl, and today we're going to take a flight experience on the B-17G Sentimental Journey out of the Commemorative Air Force Museum at Falcon Field, Mesa. It's a four-engine World War II bomber, a B-17 Flying Fortress. Ours is polished metal with the blue stripe on the tail, representing a bomb group from England in World War II in the 8th Air Force. We get to stand up, we get to walk around, we get to see the whole interior of the aircraft. You get to go to look at different windows and see a great different viewpoint out of the aircraft and see what we see. I'd always read about these aircraft in books. I'd always read about the heroics of the people who flew them. And to be able to get into the aircraft and see what they saw and experience what they experienced, at least to a very small extent, it was very, very exciting for me.
Peter Schull piloting a ride in the B-17 World War II bomber's sentimental journey at the Commemorative Air Force Museum in Mesa. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident on the 51 southbound at Bell is blocking the right lane. Valley weather for tonight. Look for partly cloudy skies and lows around 50. Slight chance for rain tomorrow with a high of 70. It's currently 71 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Camelback Volkswagen on Camelback Road and 15th Street in Phoenix, offering a full inventory of new Volkswagens and a wide variety of used cars. Online 24/7 at camelbackvw.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Richard Lee Harris. President Obama is set to defy Republicans and bypass Congress when he announces changes on immigration policy in a primetime address tonight. He's expected to spare millions living in the U.S. illegally from deportation. As NPR's Brackton Booker reports, the president's use of executive action has prompted strong pushback from Capitol Hill Republicans.
Pat Tiberi is a Republican congressman from Ohio who says the president's go-it-alone immigration strategy is all about politics.
This is so significant, so out of bounds, so inappropriate, and he knows it.
Representative Richard Dent of Pennsylvania says the president's aim is to divide the GOP.
I believe that the president is more or less goading us into some kind of hysterical reaction, and we should not take the bait.
Republicans are working on how to block the president, though many insist shutting down the government is not on the table. Brackton Booker, NPR News, the Capitol.
Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna, adding his diplomatic muscle to talks on Iran's nuclear program. NPR's Peter Kenyon in Vienna says there are growing signs that the talks aimed at a nuclear deal with Iran may have to be extended again.
Basically, everyone except those in the room are convinced that an extension is growing more likely as a Monday deadline gets closer. Both the British and French foreign ministers are speaking about getting closer to the finish line, not crossing it. Secretary Kerry refuses to talk about an extension, focusing on an intensive push this weekend to come to terms that both Iran and world powers can live with.
NPR's Peter Kenyon. Record highs today on Wall Street for the Dow and S&P 500. The Dow Jones Industrials up 33. The S&P 500 closed up 4. The Nasdaq down 26. This is NPR.
KJZZ is supported by Banner MD Anderson Cancer Center, creating customized plans with cancer treatment options for all cancer types. Information at BannerMDAnderson.com. We are all in for the fight against cancer.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. A new report paints a pretty bleak picture of life for American Indian and Native Alaska children. It says a vast majority of such kids live with alarmingly high rates of poverty, homelessness, drug abuse, suicide, and alcoholism. But the paper from the U.S. Attorney General's Advisory Committee on American Indian and Native Alaska Children Exposed to Violence also offers some recommendations to improve the situation. Former Democratic U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota is the panel's co-chair.
The trends are heartbreaking. We discovered in the hearings that we held around the country a substantial number of Indian children who have been left behind in a lot of ways, exposed to violence in many different ways, and really live lives too often in circumstances where they feel that they're helpless and hopeless. And we just desperately want to change that because the children exposed to violence on Indian reservations and Alaska Natives, has a profound impact on them for life. And we have responsibilities, trust responsibilities, treaty responsibilities, to do what is necessary to give these children a chance and to give them some hope.
Your task force obviously came up with a number of recommendations, and I'm curious how many of the things that ideally you could do are things that you just can't legislate necessarily.
Well, a lot of them you can legislate in the sense that providing additional funding, the funding that is required in the juvenile justice system and other things that can be helpful to these young people across the country who are living on Indian reservations and so on, the Congress can provide adequate funding. It just does not. And, you know, the question is, if you have signed treaties with Indian tribes over the years and you have a trust responsibility for that, how on earth can you consider that discretionary funding? I think there's a requirement for administrations and also for the Congress to provide the funding that was promised so that these children can lead better lives.
How much of the problem do you think can be traced to lack of cooperation or lack of communication between tribal law enforcement and the surrounding city or state law enforcement?
I think that's a significant issue. You know, American Indian tribes, by and large, do not have full authority to deal with the criminal justice system and the issues on their own reservations. You've got often Indian tribal justice surrounded by non-Indian systems and justice systems, and they often don't work very well together. In addition, what we hear is, you know, an area the size of the state of Connecticut, where you have 8 full-time or 9 full-time law enforcement officials, and, you know, if some young child is severely beaten on that reservation, it may be 24 to 48 hours before a call to the police has a police officer showing up. I mean, that is not protecting the rights of children or the rights of individuals. You have to have adequate funding for those law enforcement needs on those reservations.
You served in Congress. You were there for a little while. How optimistic are you that the House and Senate and the President will provide the funding necessary to at least do some of what your task force is recommending?
Well, I think there are a lot of task force and advisory committee reports that gather dust in the Congress, but this is different in the sense that it deals with children. And I don't care how hard-hearted or hard-headed you might be, you've got to understand that children are this country's priority, and especially the children of the first Americans. They have systematically been left behind. If you made a list of all those left behind in the country, in my judgment, Indian children rank near the top of the list. And it is a disgrace. It's one that must be dealt with for the sake of these children. And I hope this task force report might be the stimulant that gets the Congress and gets policymakers to make the right decisions.
Former Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan is the co-chair of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee on American Indian and Native Alaska Children Exposed to Violence.
This week, Phoenix has been the host city for the Water Resource and Irrigation Conference. Irrigation has been a method for bringing water to valley homes for decades. But in a desert made even drier by a near-historic drought, how much of a role should irrigation still be playing? Ray Quay is with ASU's Decision Center for a Desert City.
We have seen declining amounts of water being used for irrigation over the last 20 years. That's been driven by a number of factors. One of them is that people are changing their landscapes to use less water. But we're also seeing development of smaller lots and higher density, which creates less space for landscaping, so we have less water use as well.
Are there changes, technological changes, where if people are using irrigation, feel like that is works for how their home or how their neighborhood is set up, there are ways of making sure we're using less, we're reusing water, we're not wasting as much?
There aren't that many new technologies for outdoor water use. There are a few for turf-type irrigation where we can put sensors in the ground to sense exactly how much water the turf is getting so that we can target water to those areas that need it rather than overing some areas in order to get adequate water to others. But most of the management of irrigation, outdoor water use, is really focused more on how people are using it and where they're using it. And we can be wiser in how we use outdoor water use. We want it to be really more focused on the aspects of the outdoors that we really need water in order to be able to create the environments we want. Even turf can play an important role within the urban environment. There are technologies that we can use to try to irrigate turf to make it wiser. Golf courses can be designed to be more target, you know, have the turf where you need it and don't have turf where you don't need it.
Golf courses are sort of the poster child, if I can put it that way, of misuse of water. Is that fact-based?
Well, many of the golf courses in the Valley have changed the structure of the course itself, where they're more targeted golf courses, but many have moved away from using potable-type water to using reclaimed water or effluent to water them. Golf courses really play two roles within our community. One is that they're obviously a place that we go to recreate, but it's also an important component of our economy. And water cannot be removed from the economic engine that we have here in the Valley. Golf courses play a role in the economy. And if we look at how water is being used and the role the golf courses play, it seems that that's a fairly efficient use of water in terms of the economic return. That may not always be the case. And in fact, that economy is kind of changing because we're having fewer and fewer golf courses because we're having fewer and fewer plays. And so that will change over time.
As the need for conservation grows, what strategies are going to convince institutions and individuals to use less water and maybe pay more for it?
I don't hear too many people in the streets complaining about their cable bill going up. And I think one of the reasons for that is that there's a high value to that cable bill. In many cases, it's providing their internet access. That's become super important to people. It's providing entertainment. People see value in that. People are paying more for their cell phones. Who would have thought 20 years ago that you would have over a $100 a month phone bill? So people complain about it a little, but it's a super value to it. I think the issue with energy and water, with the resources, is that we need to make people understand what the value is for them, both in terms of their personal lives and comfort, but also in terms of the economy of the region. And as we begin helping people to understand that value, and we tell them, look, if we want to maintain this value, and we need to be looking at planning, and it may cost us more in the future, but I think we can demonstrate to people that there's value in that.
Ray Quay of ASU's Decision Center for a Desert City. A record drought is affecting Brazil's biggest city, Sao Paulo. Water levels are dangerously low, and state authorities have acknowledged there may be extended power cuts and other emergency measures in the new year. But Brazil has a huge percentage of the Earth's fresh water, so how can it be running out? Here's the BBC's Wira Davis in Sao Paulo.
Brazil has an estimated 12% of all the world's fresh water. It should be an abundant resource, but here in the southeastern town of Itu, Gilberto Rodriguez and his neighbors have been filling up from this emergency well for weeks. Tired of heaving jerry cans day after day back to his house, Gilberto and his wife sigh when they hear politicians say there is no water crisis. There's been no water in our pipes now for a month, says Soraya. It's not as bad as this in every community, but we've had water rationing here since February. It certainly looks like a crisis after the worst drought in 80 years. Reservoirs have reached rock bottom, and everyone's hoping the rainy season will bring a miracle. Well, some rain has returned, but this lake is still at only 10% of its capacity, and it would take an extraordinarily large amount of rainfall to return things to normal. All the while, this reservoir is part of a system that has to supply down the valley South America's biggest city, São Paulo, and 20 million people running low on water. As the city grows uncontrolled, the failure to invest in infrastructure exacerbates the problem. Open sewers mean that São Paulo's rivers are completely polluted, another waste of precious water. Maria Cecilia Brito is from the organisation Alliance for Waters, belatedly trying to raise public awareness about the chronic shortages.
People here were trained and were educated, and in their lives they thought that water was a resource that would never end, not using it wisely. And we were taking more water from the sources than the sources were able to regain through their own natural means.
There's not much of Brazil's Atlantic rainforest left, and the rate of deforestation in the Amazon has again increased. Dr. Antonio Nobre is one of Brazil's leading earth scientists and climatologists. He says the real reasons for the drought may be even more worrying for Brazil in the long run.
There is a hot, dry air mass sitting down here like an elephant, and nothing can move it. That's what we have learned, that the forests have an innate ability to import moisture and to cool down and to moisten the air and favor rain. If deforestation in the Amazon continues, probably São Paulo will dry up, because what is at stake is so grave and so serious. If we don't act now, we are lost.
Water shortages have the potential to harm the economy too, especially here in São Paulo, the city that drives Brazil's economic growth. This aluminium factory uses 15,000 litres of water a day, and the owner, Maurício Colin, is worried about future supplies. The authorities know exactly what's needed. They have to invest in basic infrastructure, says Maurício, because without water, there are companies here who won't be able to produce anything. Thus far, public protests against the water shortages have been small, but the potential for frustration and disruption is there. São Paulo's state water authority couldn't put anyone up for interview, but it has acknowledged that unless water levels recover, there may be power cuts and more water rationing. Everyone here is praying for more rain, hoping that it's not too late.
That's the BBC's Wira Davis. Good afternoon. Another nice day around the valley. And we'll stay this way for the most part. Look for partly cloudy skies tonight with lows around 50. And then for tomorrow, we'll have one day with some clouds, a slight chance for rain and a high of 70. And then over the weekend, back to mostly sunny skies and high temperatures in the lower 70s. Currently, relative humidity at 13%. We are mostly clear and 71 degrees. To the freeways, not much going on in this early part of the afternoon commute. There is one accident, though, 51 southbound at Bell Road. Be careful in that area. Now a couple of right lanes are blocked.
KJZZ is supported by Perkins Coie LLP. With more than 950 lawyers in 19 offices across the U.S., including Phoenix and in Asia, providing a full array of legal services. Online at PerkinsCoie.com.
The National Park Service is looking to deaccession some of the artifacts in its collection. It's proposed a rule change that would set up a procedure for the agency to unload objects deemed to be of insufficient archaeological interest. Human remains and other cultural items would not be eligible. For more on this proposal, I'm joined by Terry Childs, the manager of the U.S. Interior Department's Museum Program, and National Park Service spokeswoman Alexandra Picovet.
What the proposal is to make it possible for the government to deaccession artifacts that are no longer deemed significant in their archaeological status.
It means you'd be basically getting rid of them.
We would in some way be getting them out of the federal collection. That's correct.
What's the reason behind this?
The federal government, and specifically the National Park Service, has really large collections across the nation. And some of those collections include a lot of redundant and, in some cases, insignificant materials like shards of brick or shards of slag and glass, things that were collected especially in industrial areas. And they don't serve a purpose for research or inform anyone on the story of that site to the degree necessary in order to maintain it as part of the federal collection.
Terry, how do you go about determining what is of archaeological significance and what is not?
Most of the collections that are created on archaeological sites and during archaeological investigations are considered of archaeological significance as a whole collection that represents that site and the people that occupied that site in the past.
So at what point does it become insignificant or at least not significant enough to the point where the federal government might not want to have it in its collection anymore?
There are just a few criteria that would suggest that it's insignificant. And that would be one thing is that there are too many of the same objects, that they're fragments, very small, and that they do not have a research value that we think warrants their collection and preservation. We have many, many millions of archaeological objects, and sometimes there's some that whose value have been reduced over time.
Terry, is there a concern that by having such a big collection, you're not able to properly care for and maintain everything in it, and that maybe by paring it down a bit, you'll be able to do a better job maintaining the things that are of significance?
Yes, we're always looking for ways to be more efficient and effective in our management of our collections.
Alexandra, under the proposal, who would make the decision that, yes, this is something that the Park Service can deaccession?
So there's actually a rigorous procedure in order to go through. It could include consultation with tribes. It'll include a board of people who would go through the process of determining if the materials being spoken about meet the criteria in order to be deaccessioned.
Does the Park Service have an estimate as to how much money it might be able to save or how many items ultimately might be deaccessioned?
No, though we see this as a way to help to, in these days of shrinking budgets and of being strategic with how we manage our budgets, we see this as a way to be more strategic, but that's not the only reason that we're going through this. One of the largest considerations that we have when we're maintaining a large collection is space. All of these places, all of these things are being curated to the best of our ability and being held in safe areas that takes up an awful lot of space.
What will happen to the items once they're deaccessioned?
The proposed rule provides a number of alternative methods for the disposition of the objects. What we want is a safe and good home for anything that we deaccession. So our priority would be to transfer the objects to another federal agency or to a university, to a state museum, or the like. Tribal museums and tribal schools are another high priority for us.
Terry Childs manages the U.S. Interior Department's museum program. We also heard from National Park Service spokeswoman Alexandra Picovet. The comment period on the proposed rule change runs until mid-February. The final rule is expected to be published sometime later next year.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum.
Okay, so I grew up in Phoenix. I did not eat a lot of Mexican food, burritos or otherwise. That changed when I became an older man. And now we're going to have a big burrito-tasting bonanza. Look at
this. It is a bonanza.
Yeah, we've got a lot of burritos in front of us.
We sure do. We have six burritos in front of us. We're going to try three, and then we'll try three more. We're joined by one of our senior producers here, Sarah Ventry, who will be our third taste tester. Sarah, do you want to explain how this shindig is going to work here?
This is based on Nate Silver's blog, 538, which did a search for the best burrito in the entire country. And, you know, Arizona was represented, but not quite as much as I think we all would have liked to have seen. So we put out a call. You answered. You all told us what you thought were the best burritos in the city. So this is a blind taste test.
So we don't know what
we don't know what we're eating, but they, as a collective, come from La Santisima, Carolina's, Tacos de Juarez, Rito's, America's Taco Shop, and Amato's.
And to set things up, we have six plates in front of us here, each one with a letter on it. So we'll try each one. We're going to be grading them on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being amazing, 1 being, not so good. And we will calculate the totals and come up with the best burrito.
I'm eating A right now, and I'm liking it. It's a little spicy for me, though. I'm going to put my bias in. I'm going to give it a 6.
Yeah, this has a little bit of a kick to it. It was good. I would probably also give it a 6.
Okay. It's good. It does have a little bit of a kick to it. It almost looks like there are chilies in here in addition to the shredded beef. I really like this. I like the tortilla a lot on this one, too. I'd give this a 7. I really like this one.
We're going to try a burrito letter B here. This looks like a bean and cheese burrito.
Okay.
That is pretty solid. Not spicy, which I appreciate. The cheese is melted nicely. I like this one. I'm gonna give this one a 7.
Wow, okay. Tortilla is feeling a little chewy to me, but let's see what the flavor brings. Magic. That's fantastic. I have a bias toward beans and cheese. Well, I would give that actually, I think I'd give that an 8.
Wow.
I think that's really delicious.
It's just really soft, and the beans are just like really, really creamy. Such a good flavor. I'm going to give this one an 8 also.
Sarah, what kind of burrito is C?
It looks like it actually could be pork. I'm not sure yet if it's beef or pork, but it looks like it could be pork, though it's cooked in a red sauce. That meat is really, really, really good. It almost has a little tiny bit of sweetness to it in the sauce, which we haven't had before. I will say I tend to skew a little more away from that kind of sweet taste and more towards the spicy, savory side. So I'm going to give this one maybe a 6.
Okay. I will take a bite here and see what I think. I hear what you're saying about the meat. It almost tastes like it's barbecued, which is kind of an unusual flavor. I will say that I do like the tortilla. I think this might be my favorite tortilla that we've tasted so far. Also not spicy, which, again, I appreciate. I think I would probably give this one an 8. I really enjoyed this one. So, Steve, now we'll
try
C.
I will try C. That's number 3, baby. Ready for this?
I'm ready.
It's jaunty. I like this one. This has, you know, it has almost kind of a, it's kind of bubbly. It feels almost carbonated to me.
Like a soda?
It almost tastes like ginger ale or something. I wonder if there's a secret ingredient. I'm going to give this one a 7.
So we've now completed the first round. Sarah, I think, prefers burritos that are a little spicier. You and I prefer ones that are a little more geared toward wimps.
I would say that's accurate, yes.
Okay, so the winner of these three burritos was Burrito B, which was the bean and cheese burrito.
Okay.
That came out with an average score of 7.6.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, we did quite well. So tomorrow, Burrito B will be paired against the winner of the second burrito bracket, which was D, E, and F. And we will put them head to head.
You want to stay tuned for that?
Definitely.
Wow. Can't wait to see the tail of the tape on that one.
And be sure to be with us tomorrow at 2 o'clock. In addition to the thrilling conclusion of the Best Burrito Bonanza 2014, we'll have reaction from Arizona from President Obama's executive action on immigration. We'll meet the new director of the Phoenix Art Museum and a whole lot more.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, and Aubrey Abril are our digital team. The managing editor, Al Macias. Executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Email us at theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.